in order that each one of us could be the right, the suitable vehicle for the influx and the outflow of transcendent energy. It is essential that the whole psychophysical organism should be in a state of harmony, which means essentially in a state of peace. This state of peace is established through the discipline of the holy life. It is not a static condition. It is not as if we strive this way and strive that way, and the end point after such and such a period of time will be peace permanently. It is not that kind of striving at all. One has to remain awake here and now to everything that goes on, with a full awareness that the process of cleansing of both body and mind must go on simultaneously, continuously, in time. The purified organism remaining pure in course of time manifests the timeless, the transcendent real functioning through that organism. Now, we have dealt time and again with this question of purification, the purification of the body, the purification of the mind. And we have seen the relationship of the senses to the mind in this context. How important it is to understand our sense functioning and to learn to use the senses rightly, never to misuse them. Because basically it's the misuse of the senses which spoils the mind, gives it no chance to come to fruition. Now bear in mind that it is essential there should be no conflict involved here. We haven't got to down the evil. It is necessary not to take sides with whatever emerges in our daily life. Not to take sides. If I take sides with one against another person, situation, state of mind, whatever it is, if I take sides, I am embroiled in a conflict. The conflict may end in what the world commonly calls victory, overcoming evil, overcoming the enemy, and so forth. But this sort of victory is no victory in the real sense, because it never establishes peace. It never brings about the harmony of one's own being, or the harmony of one person in relation to another. All victory, which is the outcome of conflict, of war, is a destructive thing. And all conflict whatsoever, as well as what we commonly call victory, breeds further conflict, always, inevitably. There is no exception to this fact. If we understand this, we will also understand how sometimes the word of Scripture has slipped up. Be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. But the word overcome conveys to us a victory through conflict. That is the ordinary dictionary meaning, as well as our ordinary idea. It is attributed to the Buddha that he said, when he meets Upaka after the enlightenment, as he is going towards Kasi, Banaras, in order to teach, he says to Upaka, victorious over all, omniscient am I. It is also put in this form, struggle against evil states, overcome them. In that way, by conflict, you breed further evil states. There is no way out through conflict, through conquest. It is really extremely important for us to understand this and to appreciate its significance. Significance is thus, is essentially this. The cosmos is one whole cosmos, one whole universe. There is the interaction of what we call chaos and cosmos. Chaos is not originally what we mean today by chaos, disorder. Chaos means original stuff. Original stuff coming into a state of order and harmony becomes cosmos. Nowhere in the totality is there any possibility of throwing anything out of totality. Destruction is impossible. There can only be transformation. But if the mode of transformation actually, or if attempted in that way, leads to a useless breakup, then it is not part of the universal process in the right sense of the term. Back one goes into chaos, so to say, or back goes the material into chaos. Once again, it emerges into cosmos. Our task is the maintenance, is the release in the first instance, and the maintenance of harmony. Now, conflict always means destruction in some form or other. It means, in fact, the production of greater confusion. It means the disequilibration of forces and energies which are trying all the time to come to a state of dynamic equilibrium, of dynamic poise. The healthy, happy person is in a dynamic poise, not static. So conflict is no way. And the worst consequence of conflict is that conflict precludes understanding. See what happens in history in the ordinary way. There is a war. One party is supposed to win and the other party is supposed to lose. What next? Both parties have to sit round a table and come to an agreement, at least. Now, in order to come to the right agreement, which will release a true friendship, a true human relationship between them, it is necessary to be free of the seeds of further conflict. In that process. And no treaties in history are free of the seeds of further conflict. Not a single one. There is no such thing as a just peace or treaty which is the result of conquest. It's a historical fact. And it is a fact in our lives. Compromise cannot do it. We have to be considerate and understanding in the true sense, in the sense of perfect wisdom and perfect love. This we must really appreciate. Now, I mentioned a few moments ago, not to take sides. If I don't take sides with this or that element in me, which are conflicting elements, if I don't take sides, but patiently, continuously examine them both, remaining quiet, that is to say, remaining as free as possible of my preconceptions, my assumptions, my criteria, my particular values, and all the rest of it, which come to interfere with my observation always. If I am quiet in that way and examine what is happening and going on, and if there are elements which are not in a state of harmony, then at last that way I can understand them. There is no understanding possible in a situation in a state of conflict. No understanding possible. And you see, the understanding has to be total. Take the case of an artist, a creative artist. Supposing a man is something of a poet. If he's only something of a poet and not the real perfect artist, there'll be flaws in his poem, which your expert can easily spot. So same with a composer, music. Your composer has to have complete mastery over the whole art of music. And then his inspiration can be used by him to produce something which is alive, something which is a source of inspiration to everyone else also. It is flawless music. There isn't a mistake in it. It has to be total, you see, complete. It is the same with us. Our understanding has to be total. And in this, we must not take sides and enter into conflict. So you see, the essential factor, keeping quiet and remaining perfectly alert and watchful all the time. This way, the whole psychophysical organism can arrive at a state of harmony and continue to live and function in a state of harmony, at peace. One has to practice this, constantly practice it. The great difficulty is to be free of our ideas, our beliefs. We take to a system of philosophy, a system of religious doctrine, or whatever it is. And when we catch hold of the system as such, we lose touch with the inner meaning, the living reality, which that externalized shape, the system, is trying to represent. But if the life is gone, we have only a dead set of words. If you really look into this and see how true it is, we will understand why that although we try to live the religious life, as we call it, we are so keen upon it, we bend all our energies to it, as we say, somehow there is disappointment. Because the life has eluded us. The life has eluded us because we ourselves have prevented that living thing from entering into us. Because we are full of our particular ideas and our beliefs. So, when we study religious truths, as we call them, we study with a mind that is not properly prepared to study. And the proper preparation for study is to have the mind completely open, not cluttered with ideas, with thought forms. As long as those thought forms are there, and the more firmly they are there, falsely parading under the name of faith, the more effectively do they shut out the living reality of truth. You know, if one really touches this at any time during the day, in our everyday life, we will suddenly touch the transcendent real. The transcendent real is free of all limitations, the limitations imposed by form and structure and process and all the rest of it. We will live through the form and structure and the moving process and all the rest of it. We will live through it, but we will live through it free and not bound by the structure and the form. Because the mind is clean in the true sense. Continuously, thoughts, feelings, ideas will come into the mind from outside maybe, or they will emerge out of our own mind by themselves. This will go on continuously, but the trouble comes when we grasp them, hold them tight and say, now I've got the truth. This is the trouble. We cling to the shape, and thereby lose our touch with the living reality. The living reality is a perpetual mystery. We can never know it in the sense of a seeing subject coming to know the seen object. As long as that separation is there between the seeing subject and the seen object, only discriminative consciousness is at play, and that is purely intellectual knowing. But the realization of truth is a case of being it and not knowing it. If we may put it in personalistic forms, I always say God does not know at all that He is God. He just doesn't know. He's entirely ignorant He is God. He is God. And that is why He doesn't know that He is God. Now, take an analogy here. Despite all our talk, and some of it is so absurd, when we say, oh, I am not the body, I am not the feelings, I am something mysterious, different, you see, some airy-fairy, mythical nonsense. But in actual fact, we live right through our life, 24 hours every day, in purely bodily terms. Every time you say or think of yourself, you say I. And by I you mean this bodily organism. Have you ever tried to divest self-awareness from the fact of your body? You tried. Try it hard as you like. You will find that the mind will play all sorts of tricks. You'll have lots of fun and games, but they will be only fun and games and not the real thing. You are this organism. If you are not this organism, you are not the particular you, John Smith or Mary Brown, that you are. But you'll be something else instead, Billy Brown or Ann Jones or Margaret Court. See? This has to be carefully borne in mind. The mind will play tricks with the body. Now, when I am at ease and not trying to analyze this I sense, how naturally and easily my I sense is completely associated with this, the body. It is completely associated with it. And it is so completely associated with it, it is so much it itself, the body itself, that you never think of it. You don't know that it is so. You are it, but you don't know it. Now, we must take a further step. We are this thing. All right. If and when the question arises in our minds, what is this? The moment the question is asked and a subject-object relationship is set up, then I talk of the body as different from the I. But this is talk. The body is talking about itself, playing hide and seek with itself. Why the hide and seek? Why the query? Is it that we seek reality? We seek the final truth about ourselves or about the body. But we cannot seek final truth. You cannot seek that which totally and completely enfolds you, in which you subsist altogether. You cannot query that. You don't know what it is. You never can know. It can never be an object of examination or perception. We can't ask questions about infinity apart from saying the word. In just precisely the same way, we cannot ask questions of God, about God. They are senseless on the whole. We cannot ask questions about the Buddha nature, as we call it. We cannot ask questions about Nirvana or the kingdom of heaven or anything like that. In this sense of objective knowledge, an object of examination, exploration, research, and through the examination and research, you acquire knowledge. All that we acquire is a whole set of thought forms, of ideas, of conceptions, which are spun out of our own minds like a spider spins the web out of his own body. Then you see what the spider does? He waits till the fly comes in and eats him up. Now we do the same. We spin out our webs and wait for something to come along and be caught in that web, and we eat that up. Another convert to the truth, as we call it. Now, this is the impure state. Bodily purity we understand within limits, don't we? At least external cleanliness we understand. But not a sufficient number of people in the world understand internal cleanliness of the body, which is a question of food and drink and exercise and rest and air and light and all the rest of it. However, on the whole, there is plenty of knowledge in connection with the body. And since the body is a particular separate object as such, an animate object as such, it can acquire knowledge with regard to what is right and good and useful for it. But the mind is different. You cannot acquire knowledge, acquire bits of knowledge for the mind, for what is good and right and beneficial for the mind. Because there is no such thing as the mind. When the person is wholly pure, he has no mind at all, which he can call, and he wouldn't want to call, his own mind. There's no such thing. Each person goes through a whole lot, a continuous series of mental states. We name these phenomena, mental states, because we have no other way of talking about it as yet. Psychical states, mental states. We are aware that this which we call a psychical or mental state, compared with the physical state, can be termed immaterial. The physical state is material, we say, and the mental state is immaterial. But a particular thought, a particular feeling, a particular mood, it emerges, it's like a cloud, more or less, you see, and the cloud disperses, it vanishes. What we call our own minds are just a continuous succession of mists and fogs. And we in England ought to appreciate that better than in many countries. But this is precisely what constitutes our mind. When we say that we've got hold of a very valuable thought, what we have got hold of is a string of words which unquestionably has meaning, which unquestionably arose because of living experience at a particular time and place. Then we catch hold of that form and entomb it by will. So the mind doesn't remain open. Mind in its reality, in its totality, is completely open, it is completely empty, completely transparent. It is not plagued with any sort of limitation. It knows freedom in a way that absolutely beggars our imagination as to what freedom means. It itself is of the nature of a dimension of being which utterly transcends the dimensions that we know. In our ordinary everyday experience. Now you see, we cannot take that which is of a dimension which utterly transcends our dimensions and pack that into our limited number of dimensions. We can't do it.
but we can become it. Look, I've said this before, haven't I? You can't take a cube, a solid cube, and pack it into a flat square. It is impossible. Mathematically, it can be conceived. You and I can all conceive it. We don't need to be mathematicians. If you just have a flat surface, a square, you can't take a solid object and pack it into that flat, say a piece of paper. You can't pack it into that flat piece of paper. Totally impossible. You see? But this flat piece of paper, or if you like to go still further, take just a straight line, is contained in this three-dimensional physical universe as we know it. Similarly, we, with our dimensions, are completely contained in this mystery. But if I were a flat piece of paper, I'd never know what on earth a cube is. I cannot. I cannot know it objectively in my paper way. You get it? So too with mind. So too with transcendence. God, Brahman, Nirvana, Tathata, Suchness, Shunyata, emptiness, the void. We play about with the words. But for us humans, there is a possibility which a flat piece of paper has not got in relation to a solid cube. This element of mind, this which we name mind, this infinite, formless, shapeless, immeasurable thing, mind, does function through us. This mind is ill as it functions in us. Mind in itself isn't ill. It is when mind functions through us, this functioning through us, mind, is ill. And its diseases are greed and hate and delusion and ambition and jealousy and avarice and envy and stupidity, clumsiness, and all the rest of it. These we can see through. We can understand. If we are going to persist in our folly, we'll take sides with God, with infinity, with Brahman, with the good, and fight against our greed and our envy and our ambition. That is hopeless. It's quite impossible to do it that way. We will just be quiet, alert, watchful, all the time. Noting every element that comes up in the mind, in our brain, as we are watching. Because all the time there will be the impulses to, oh, let's get rid of this, this is bad, this is evil. All right, get rid of it in that way, and in some mysterious way, another evil will come up. You know the good old story of getting rid of one devil out of the house and seven devils came in. See, these people were psychologists who said such things. They knew what they were talking about. So not that way. But by remaining quiet and watchful, understanding of greed, understanding of ambition comes about. And this understanding is not a merely brilliantly intellectual analysis or perception. A perception of greed as an object of perception. It is not that. When you realize that this thing which I am looking at is what I commonly call myself. When the realization is there, not merely the flow of words in the brain, that this greed is only myself. This is a different thing. Realization. When that realization is there, the words will vanish, and what was greed, like this cloud, will just disperse completely. It doesn't mean that this energy, this psychical energy, or rather psychophysical energy, which misexpressed itself as greed, is thrown away or destroyed. It is my energy itself, and it gets transformed into another kind of expression, which is non-greed. You cannot bring this about deliberately. You have to heal the greed. You have to heal that psychical energy which has got entangled, misexpressed, through ignorance, through various stimuli, out of our own physical constitution, glands and all the rest of it and so forth, you see. You've got to take hold of it as such. Look at it, and in that looking there is the transforming. This is the process of yoga in the great sense. What does the yogi do when he sits in meditation for hours, day after day? Have you ever inquired what he does? Do you think he sits down and has marvelous conversations with gods and angels and Dhyani Buddhas and what not? This is how all the scriptures have written about it. This is how the mystics have talked. And the Blessed Virgin showed herself to me most sweetly and this and that. And of course the reader sees wonderful pictures of Blessed Virgins looking all lovely and so heavenly and all the rest of it. Or such and such a Dhyani Buddha, or the wrathful deities, or the benevolent deities of the Mahayana and so forth. Or as the Buddha says in the Theravada, you say, and suddenly such and such a deva appeared and the whole wood was absolutely filled with light and so forth. Do you think that our materialistic interpretation of all that, our so-called objective interpretation, has any relationship to truth, to reality? Not a bit of it. None. So, when we read about yogis who sit in meditation, and you know, it is even said in some of the scriptures that sat like that for 3 years without moving. I don't believe a word of that. I flatly reject it. And if he did, what a waste of time. Showing off. No, but in the real thing, in the real yogic meditation, what is going on? There is an actual transformation of energy going on, of the misexpressed energies, which are retained in our subconscious, our unconscious, use whatever word you like. The mental impressions upon which arise in the organism as the result of stimuli, continuous stimuli from the moment we are born, external stimuli as well as internal stimuli. External stimuli of all sorts, including our socio-cultural heritage and our conditioning, our education, our upbringing and all the rest of it. All these mental impressions remain locked up in the organism. This organism is a vast storehouse of titanic energy. We have no conception of what it is like. Titanic energy. Modern science has revealed to us something of the nature of the physical energies involved. All the atoms which constitute the average-sized human body. And this, the scientists say that they are roughly, the number of atoms constituting the average-sized human body is roughly about 10 to the power 27 or 28. That is one with 27 or 28 noughts after it. Don't start counting now, because you'll have to live a million years before you can finish counting that much. But that's roughly the number of atoms constituting us. And each single atom is a storehouse of tremendous energy. So, the body, just looking at the living organism physically only, has all this energy stored up in it. And then, this which is the measurable energy which we can deal with, electrical, heat, whatever it is, and so forth. In addition to that, there is this immeasurable, unknown energy which we cannot deal with, which the ancients called akashic energy, akashic power. From the Akasha come all the archangels and angels and all the angelic and demonic orders. This is the mythological form in which they expressed it. But it is a real energy, because you and I, in our own daily lives, know that a thought, the thought in itself, that is, which is non-physical, non-measurable. This is the important thing. You see? The thought or the feeling impels us to action, sets in motion physical things. How? Obviously, it's a power, isn't it? It's a force. We have to reckon with it. We cannot say that thought, feeling is non-existent. It is there, it is impelling us to action all the time. Therefore, this mystery of the mind, of an energy which is immeasurable, formless, dimensionless, is constantly operating in our lives. And as I said a little earlier, it is infinite. Now, just try and sense, what an extraordinary thing each one of us is. A living human being. A storehouse, which is a limited thing. And that storehouse is this body itself. A storehouse of immense physical energies, which by no means exhaust the energies of the total universe, the physical universe, but also mysteriously a storehouse, if you like, of this infinite energy, power. It is this infinite energy which works through the measurable energies in order to bring all the forms of manifestation to fruition. Look how beautiful the sun is. How wonderful the sun is. And the planets and the stars and sand and mud, wonderful mud. The seas, the seashore, the mountains, the trees, grass, flowers, insects, birds, animals, you and I. Just feel how wonderful all of this is. And how each order of creation has its fruition and its fulfillment. And it is not a static fruition or a static fulfillment. It is alive all the time. Wonderful, thrilling. You know, if you really awake to this, you will never be miserable. You have no time or opportunity, no chance to become miserable. The reality of the universe, the reality of it is so extraordinary. Now with us human beings, we have the power, par excellence, to spoil this emergence to fruition. Deliberately to spoil it from within ourselves. Through our slavery to passion, desire, and all the rest of it. And undeliberately we spoil it because of our ignorance. And our ignorance is not our fault. Do remember that. Don't think of it in terms of fault. Otherwise we'll be caught up in this idiotic opposition of praise and blame, of reward and punishment. Not that way. This is how it happens. Don't ask the wrong questions in relation to truth, in relation to reality. Don't ask the wrong questions. Ask the right questions. Now, if we have the power deliberately to spoil, this is where we can start our real work. Observe in which way our deliberate action and our thought and our feeling spoils the emergence of pure man in each and every one of us. In past months we have considered for a little while, at least superficially we have considered, the meaning and significance of man. Man, from the root man, meaning to think. But this think is not just a discursive stream of words, a mere series of thought forms succeeding each other. This thinking is power in action which releases shape and form and substance. This is one of the meanings of God the Creator. And every religion which has the word God in it, the first thing that is ascribed to God is God the Creator, isn't it? And if you don't use the word Creator, you say Father. But Father is the fellow who created me. See? So, thought. Man is the thinker. This perfect man, this heavenly man,
is this mysterious energy which we may call mind, if you like. And in fact, the Hermetic teachings, as they come through their Hellenistic form, refer to God as All Father Mind. It's a very fascinating thing, you see. So, this mind is this creative power, mysterious, a mystery, and nevertheless embodied in us, and wanting to come out to its full fruition as man, which is identical with saying to its full fruition as God. See, all the religions, even Buddhism in its Mahayana form, introduces the word God quite a bit, doesn't it? All right. All the religions have used this word God. But we have never even begun to touch and thrill to, vibrate in sympathy with the real meaning of that word. And the real meaning is this power, this energy, essentially and ultimately. Our touch with it has been translated into the forms of thought and imagination. That is why we have made pictures all the time, and we've been caught up in those pictures. But it is an energy. It is an energy quite, no, I better be careful not say quite, but somewhat like this. If there is a fire, it is radiating heat, isn't it? Heat is a form of energy. If you put your hand near enough, you will feel the effects of that energy. You see? After you feel the effects of the energy, then you'll start talking about this experience of that energy. But unless you have studied science, and science has been able to investigate the nature of that energy and put it in a far more accurate form as to what it itself is in its own nature. Unless you've done that, we will make all sorts of fantastic statements about heat. Won't we? This is precisely what we do with respect to the transcendent, to the unknown. We can't pack that mysterious unknown, the infinite unknown, into this finite known, myself the organism. Can't pack it into that. But it is there. You can sense it. It is an energy. It is a power. It is a mystery. Not to be sought. It will take you completely into itself if you don't resist. This is very, very important. Now, we cease to resist only when we are pure. In the impure state, we are naturally resistant to this transcendent real. We are impure. So the transcendent real cannot quite utilize us, that's all. You see the paramount importance of purity. The whole of the Zarathustrian religion is founded on that one word, purity.
holiness.
Usher, as it is said, Usher. That's holiness, purity.
The Buddha constantly talked of purity. The purification of the senses, the purification of the mind. Not through conflict, taking sides, but by mindfulness. And through proper mindfulness, non-conflicting mindfulness, understanding grows and compassion grows. Divine compassion grows. And when this understanding and compassion grows, then we are becoming free of our obstructiveness to this transcendent energy, this transcendent power. This is very important. It goes right to the heart of the matter. It is a case of all and everything. So now, this heavenly man, if you like, is coming to fruition in this kind of organism. This transcendent energy has come to fruition in terms of suns and stars. They perform their task quite freely and without let or hindrance. It has come to fruition in terms of the growing of the fruit and the flower. It just happens like that. But it has not come to fruition yet in terms of mankind. We are still evolving, and our evolution is not merely something which can be restricted to the biological aspect of us, but to every aspect of us. The scientist hasn't touched this matter of the evolution of the mind or the evolution of consciousness. The evolution of consciousness can be put in better form, perhaps, by saying an unfolding of consciousness. Like a flower, like a bud, unfolds and opens out, and then in its full flowering it is perfect beauty. So consciousness does this, it flowers out that way. It's an unfolding, because consciousness has no bodily shape or form or substance. But it is more comparable to the flower. So this purification, this observation, which is not confined to oneself, the subject, looking at the processes of the mind as the object. When the looking becomes sufficiently intense and sufficiently real, the distinction between the seer, the onlooker, and the seen vanishes. The distinction vanishes. And in that vanishing, there is transformation. The purification is complete. And it may well be that the very physical cells of the body themselves undergo change. We don't know. We have the hints of this in terms of transfiguration. The Holy One is transfigured. What is this transfiguration? in an interesting and in a limited sphere, we have this curious phenomenon of certain people who have, as they say, healing power with their hands. And it's true, something happens in certain situations. This phenomenon takes place. You see, it may not bring permanent results. That's neither here nor there. The fact is that the phenomenon did take place. You see, so some people have this something about them. Therefore, some energy goes out which changes the ill condition. Now it's the same with us in our own inner being. We can release this, or shall I put it this way? We can ease the paths by which this energy of transcendence can bring to flower in each one of us the heavenly man, the perfected holy one. And this is the task of the yogi, of the mystic, of the religia. I'm just using the simple terms. In India we have all this scale of Raja Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga. They are all different ways. They are different only with a slight difference. The difference isn't great. Basically they are the same. It is just like mankind experiencing hunger, basic to every single human being, and satisfying hunger by taking food, which is basic to every human being. The differences occur where what food you take is concerned. That's all. See, one man may satisfy his hunger with bananas and another with a beefsteak. But that's neither here nor there. If we confine our attention, if we wear blinkers and look only at the object, the food which is being used, then we will have fun and games quarreling about the whole situation. But if we understand the overriding reality. There's hunger, and food satisfies hunger. Basic facts, universal. Now, do you appreciate the sort of enormity of meditation? Of the living of the religious life and what it means. And do realize, above all, it means one's own real happiness. The happy state is one which is the healthy state of mind. And the healthy state of the mind is one in which there is no conflict. And there is no conflict if we are sensible enough not to take sides, but be observant. Be awake and observant. Don't take sides. Then the mind is healthy. See, when we don't take sides, don't imagine, therefore, that the world process won't throw up situations of strain and difficulty and problems and so forth. Of course it will. But when we don't take sides, what happens is that what appear to be conflicting opposites in the mind are really undergoing a tension a balanced tension of opposites. Take with the body, if you have the balance of opposing tensions, the body becomes stronger. When you take exercise, for instance, what are you doing? But if you don't have a balance of opposing tensions when you take exercise, then your development, your muscular development, will be lopsided. You won't develop healthily. Take two lads who engage in a little friendly wrestling, you see. Now, engaging in a friendly wrestle like that, there is a degree of balance observed. The one doesn't hurt the other in the process. They try each other out. And each, you know, works in such a manner as to balance the opposing force. Now, in that process, there is growth. So, when the mind doesn't take sides, this balance of opposing tensions is present, which strengthens the mind. You become more perceptive. You see more clearly. You see the thing in proper perspective, and so forth. And so the mind is healthy, and the healthy mind is the happy mind. Not the mind which is merely in a state of pleasure. Happiness never begins, it never ends. Just as compassion and wisdom never begin and never end. They are these things, happiness, compassion, wisdom, goodness, are constitutive of mind. This is mind itself. Mind is made up of these elements, if you like to look at it that way. Just as the body is made up of bones, flesh, blood, and all the rest of it, you see. So, mind is constituted out of happiness, wisdom, love, and so forth. And since mind in itself is transcendent, dimensionless, infinite, formless, love, wisdom, truth, goodness are also transcendent. So, appreciate the task. And live happily.